Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Music Biz Podcast presented by Hypebot.com. I'm your host, Kyle Boleyn. Today on the show, we're talking with Phil Hutchin, who is the founder and CEO of Dice, a live music discovery platform. It allows fans to find shows and buy tickets without any booking fees. We talked to Hutchin about the current state of the live music sector and how it's going to change in the coming years. Make sure that you subscribe to Music Biz Podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow the show and get the latest updates on SoundCloud. And if you like the show, I'd love for you to rate us highly and submit a review in iTunes. Here is Courtney Harding's interview with Phil Hutchin.
So for listeners that might not be familiar with Dice, can you tell us a little bit about what the company does, what you're trying to achieve, and what your role as the CEO entails?
Cool. So if you haven't heard of Dice, that's totally fine. I mean, first of all, we only launched in September last year, and September the 18th is our first anniversary. We were in testing before then. We did lots of conversations with the music industry, specifically sort of from venues to promoters to artists and fans. We launched in London last year. Dice is 100% mobile, so you can't buy tickets via a website. It's the first time that fans can discover and buy tickets to the best gigs, all with no booking fees. We spent a lot of time trying to make Dice beautiful and super simple as well. And we're a launch partner with Apple Pay, so you can actually register and buy a ticket with just your thumb, which is kind of cool. But also, we have a world-class editorial team that handpick the gigs that actually make it under Dice. So we say no as much as we say yes to in terms of the shows that we have in Dice. So that means that you don't have to sift through them. I think that, especially in London or lots of cities around the world, that there's so many great concerts going on too that it's enough just to kind of concentrate on those guys.
And so what is your role as a CEO look like?
I think it's kind of like the mix in terms of, okay, rather than sort of where it is now, maybe it's kind of like the evolution to where it got to now. Because of my background is in the music industry, so had a record label, Modular Records, and then a management company. It's called Deadly People, and the things that it never really bothered me about ticketing. In fact, ticketing was literally the thing that bothered me the least. It's such a boring thing to kind of like get involved with. But over the last sort of few years, before we started Dice, it kind of started worrying me that when I did a concert deal with one of my artists, that the ticket price would just dramatically increase from like $30 to $45, and there was nothing that I could do about it. And not only that, it's like you'd spend years building up an artist, and when you got to a certain level, like when you got big, you do big high fives around the place, and like, wow, I can't believe we've sold out this venue. This is so cool. But then literally minutes afterwards, their tickets would be online for like 10 times the price, and you had no control over it, and then fans would get pissed off with you, and you're kind of like in this thing. And when you start questioning, like, why is this happening, you sort of get people saying, well, you better shut up, because otherwise your artist won't be playing XYZ festival. So the thing is that kind of took a little bit of time off. When I say a little bit of time, it's like a few weeks, so it wasn't too long. Just like really thinking deeply about sort of what the issues were, wrote them all down. And actually, when you mentioned sort of Robbie Williams' manager, because you're talking about an artist who sells millions of tickets, a huge pop artist, kind of, and went to his management and told him the idea of Dice, of it being mobile, to be unable to resell the ticket, have no booking fees, all this kind of crazy talk, and he loved it. And so then went to Sinks and Mills, who have a company called Us2. So Us2 is based in London, New York, Malmo, and it's like a design product studio. They created the game Monument Valley, which was Apple's game of the year last year. It's like this beautiful game. It's in a house of cards as well. But actually, when I've known Sinks and Mills for years, and just largely from the pub, and we kind of just met up a few times just talking about it. And originally, the idea was like, can they build the prototype? And then from that, they hadn't done a joint venture before, but we kind of worked out, let's put our heads together. It's actually quite a big sort of problem to solve. It's, you know, put the design obsession, the technology, the music industry and sort of together and kind of see what we can come up with. So going back to your original question about sort of the CEO role, I think that first is coming up the idea, which is kind of scary, like how the hell can I do this? Then you get people who sort of join you on this mission sort of as your co-founders, and you're like, God, now I've introduced these guys to this problem, and now I have to be responsible for them. And then you start building up like a product team, and then you suddenly see like four or five people like working on this idea and sort of building an app, and you're like, oh my God, like now these guys, I'm responsible for them as well. What about if this doesn't work? And then you have to raise money to kind of like really make the ambition that you've kind of sort of put forward. So then you have to go out, and I had never raised money before. So that, you know, when another job was to go out and start talking to investors and, you know, tell them about the idea and what the business was behind it. I mean, it's such a radical rethink as well that you're not making money from the transactions, but thinking more imaginative about other sort of possible revenue streams. And then you raise the money, and then you're like, oh no, now I've got co-founders, people who are working on their product. Now we have this money that we have to sort of, you know, put aside and sort of launch the product. And then suddenly you kind of have that all these insecurities along the way, and then you launch the product, and you're like, wow, what if it doesn't work? And then weirdly from that point onwards, it's when you can see that it's starting to work, then it's about sort of focus. And I think that most of my role as CEO is just making sure that we listen to all the ideas and all the opportunities and everything else, but ultimately kind of stay focused on what's really important to DICE, making sure that the three things that sort of is our sort of company culture, which is around, you know, is this the right thing to do? When is it a good time to say no?
So just kind of moving on from that a little bit, how are music discovery and event discovery different in your mind? And I'd like you to talk about the experience you believe fans are looking for in event discovery and how DICE provides that to them.
Okay. I never really thought of event discovery and music discovery as separate. So it's kind of, I mean, I'm thinking about it now. I still don't see them as separate. I think that we didn't, so for example, with DICE, the first of all was getting trust with our audience, with the fans, that if they go into DICE, that they can listen to any artist that's on DICE and feel, you know, comfortable and confident that's going to be good. Might not be quite your taste and genre or whatever else, but it's going to be a good artist, whether it's club night or a festival or a band. But what is interesting is that before May, it was just event discovery, and that you had to trust us that they were good. We didn't have music integrated into the app. And what happened was that when we introduced the Spotify play button for all of the events, our sales jumped up by 50% in the first month and continued to sort of rise. I think that what people just wanted that extra sort of little bit of trust and information and music to kind of like be sure that they want to go to it.
The thing that I really think about music discovery and event discovery is, with music discovery, to me, it's very, very low touch, right? It's like someone gives you a playlist of 50 songs, you put it on the background, and you're discovering the music technically, but you're not really engaging with it that much. Whereas event discovery, the barrier to entry is clearly much higher, right? You have to give up time, you have to give up, an evening, there's coordination involved, there's transportation involved. If you're someone who has a family, there's babysitters involved. And, you know, that barrier to entry to me seems much, much higher for so many people. But there's a disconnect between the music discovery and the event discovery that I think you guys are bridging, where, you know, if I'm listening on a streaming service, I'm not necessarily being served then like information about the live event. Whereas if I'm being served something on your service, I can then sort of work backwards and see, okay, do I like this? Is this interesting?
Yeah, actually, that's a really valid point. I say this quite a lot. I think that the data that we have in terms of understanding fan behavior is stronger than someone just listening to a track. Like, I listen to music all day. I mean, constantly being sent stuff, listen to playlists. And it's an investment, but it's not really much of an investment. You listen to it, and quite often only listen to it once. But the magic and time taken to actually go see something live is pretty big, and also putting your money behind something as well. You're right. The difference between music and event discovery is different. But they're also sort of tied up. I think that you listen to something, and you're like, oh, that sounds pretty good. I wouldn't mind going to see those guys again, or for the first time.
So people have been innovating in the recorded and digital music space for 15 plus years now. And you mentioned this a little bit earlier, innovation in the live space has been much more recent. And the sort of, I think your view was like, oh, the ticketing is kind of boring and, you know, there's only so much you can do. But now people are really starting to iterate a lot. So why do you think that, A, it's taken so long for people to innovate in the live space? And B, why do you think there is now a lot of innovation in the live space?
I think it's mobile. I think it's us as society are demanding transparency. I think that things are changing and disrupting faster than ever before. And, you know, people use the word disrupt fairly lightly, but I think that in the music industry, it is actually a place which needs that radical change. I think that it kind of bums me out when I see so much debate and energy spent on streaming, when it's like, guys, streaming is done. We just need to work out a better monetization in terms of delivering it and contracts and whatever else. But as a tool, like, it's over. I think that for me, it was the, you know, suddenly realizing that the booking fee and the ticket fee and the transaction fee didn't make sense anymore. Because the thing is that there's no longer someone printing off a ticket and putting it into a little envelope and mailing it out to you, and then you turning up and getting scanned and all that kind of, that's all gone, because a ticket is electronic and delivered to your phone. So where is the overheads in that? And so I think that people are kind of cluing in and like, why am I paying this? Why am I paying to print off my ticket at home? Like, that seems kind of ridiculous. And so I think people just kind of looking at something that's pretty obvious and saying, this is not right.
Yeah, and to sort of follow on that, why do you think the live music experience has really stayed the same over so many years? I mean, I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about the lack of innovation in the live space, and I said, you know, I went to a concert in 1995, and I went to a concert to see the same band when they did a reunion tour last summer, and the experience was pretty much exactly the same. Like, there was not a lot of difference in terms of how I experienced the show. And that's ridiculous, because so much has changed in the last 20 years. And, you know, why haven't people been innovating? And then why have so many companies and venues just been really hesitant to improve the experience?
I kind of mentioned before chatting about listening to a podcast this morning, and it was about healthcare in America. And the guy was asked the same question. Why? I mean, the healthcare seems to be, you know, it's something like $4 trillion spent on healthcare in the U.S. every year, and a trillion of that is just wasted. And to put into context, I think it's something like $80 billion is spent on digital advertising, just to put it in sort of scale. And his answer was that there's no incentive for the incumbents to actually to disrupt or reform or do anything different, because the money is there, and it's like, well, why would I change things when it works? And the thing is that if I change it, then I'm going to have new competition and whatever else. So I think that there's definitely the same thing. And when they were talking about it, I could totally identify that with the music industry. I think that there's systems in place and contracts in place, where a lot of money is stable, and there's no real incentive for the big players to introduce something new.
Right, but that's like the innovator's dilemma. I mean, you just pretty much summed up the position of the incumbent companies in the innovator's dilemma, which I think they were like disk drive companies or something, which don't even exist anymore. But, you know, they were sort of sitting there and they're like, well, we're doing great. Everything's fine. And then they're just sort of like someone comes out of left field and knocks them over because they're so comfortable in their position. And I mean, healthcare is in the US especially, which is a disaster and obviously very, very much more complicated. But, you know, I can see in live music where, you know, people are eventually going to, it's eventually going to dip, right? Like you can't continue on forever without innovating because yeah, even though live music is its own bubble, like there are other things people could do with their leisure time. So they're not competing against other venues. They're competing against like video games and restaurants and basketball games and 50 million other things that people could be doing. So that's where I sort of get worried about live music is like, they've cruised along for this long, but you know, the audience for live music is kind of a small slice of the population to begin with for the most part. So what do they do in that small slice of the population who's used to being super served all of a sudden is like, oh, this isn't as much fun. I'm going to go, you know, make YouTubes with my friends or whatever.
Yeah. Your first point about the dilemma, for the incumbents and sort of people coming in is, yeah, it's true. I think also the competition is true as well. I mentioned for the first time last week that, you know, who is our competition? Our competition is Netflix because, you know, I'm quite happy to go and watch BoJack Horseman or whatever else some days of the week. But, you know, what's the alternative to doing that? And I think that the reason that we took our time in launching, I mean, when I say took our time, long time in I guess the tech space, like 6 months, was that we were having conversations with venues we imagined would be most resistant to Dice coming in with this transparent, no booking fees. He's the gigs, just buy a ticket. Or, you know, we have a thing called waiting list as well, which means that if it is sold out, you add yourself to the waiting list, which means that if someone can't make the gig, they send the ticket back and whoever's on top of the waiting list gets an opportunity to buy it. That solves like a huge problem, which we didn't even know existed, which was people buy tickets to concerts and then, you know, then it's raining or they can't make it or whatever else. And the venues are less full, there's less beers bought and all that kind of stuff. And so the venues looked at us as a threat, but then saw us as, oh, actually they can help us get to fill the venues. So before we launched, a lot of people said that you're not going to get the shows that you want. There's too many parties that are benefiting of the existing system. But something weird happened in that we got all the gigs that we wanted. They went up onto Dice. We sold out a lot of them. We sold out shows that the promoter didn't think were going to sell out. And, you know, 11 months on, we're kind of outselling pretty much all of like sort of like competitors in London that, and I think that's largely because fans know that it's the fair price on Dice and there's no other things around it. But also around the discoverability, I think that most gigs aren't sold out because people probably don't know that they're going on because they are watching Netflix or whatever else. Like, you don't really go on to ticketing websites to type in what's happening this week. Like, you need to present information in a particular way, and that's something that, you know, we're trying our best to sort of do.
So, you know, I was going to ask next about sort of the single biggest problem in ticketing, but I think that we've covered a lot of that. But one of the things that I wanted to cover with you, because you mentioned this in terms of like the wait list and in terms of, you know, the sort of ability for people to resell in your platform, is that no one is ever quite sure what the ideal price for a ticket is. And I'll sort of give you an example. So I wanted to go see Slater Kinney play in New York City because they're one of my favorite bands. Mm-hmm. Tickets for that show were $35. It sold out immediately. And then I went on StubHub and the tickets were, I think the cheapest ticket was $70. And as you got closer to the show, the tickets went up quite considerably. So no one is ever quite sure what the demand is and what the sort of price elasticity is. So they're not letting the market set the cost of the ticket. And so what you get is a sort of extreme skew to one side. But the problem is the artists don't see any of that. So, you know, in this sort of post StubHub and Craigslist world, you know, the artists are having to sort of price artificially low, but it doesn't make sense because then they're leaving all this money on the table. So, you know, the thing that I think about, which I think a lot of people would hate, but I think makes sense, is the Uber for tickets, where the demand, where there's a floor, right? Like Uber has a floor, but then demand drives the ceiling. So if it's just a nice day, you know, Tuesday afternoon, and I'm just wanting to take an Uber somewhere, the price is going to be X. And if it's New Year's Eve and it's pouring rain and I want to get home, the price is going to be X times 10 because the demand is so much higher. So I just wanted to sort of throw out that idea and see what you've thought of it in terms of, should there be more sort of like elasticity when it comes to pricing of concert tickets?
Yeah. So this is something that, you know, we need more data on, but it's definitely something that we, I mean, a huge chunk of DICE is that it's a data company. It's looking at pricing. It's looking at the demand for concerts at certain times. We can advise a promoter, hey, don't put your concert on sale this time. You should put it on this time to this audience and you'll have a better chance of selling out. I think that one of my frustrations as a manager was that I didn't know what the price should be for a concert. I didn't know if I should play two, or the artist should play two, you know, 2,500 cap venues, or go straight to doing a 5,000 or a 10,000. There's no real business intelligence around that. A lot of it's done through instinct. So what happens is that, I mean, I love Slater Kenny. It's like, if they came into town and they wanted to just do a small show, they should totally do that. But if there's a lot of demand, then they should, you know, hopefully come back and do like a bigger concert. But there's always that doubt because you don't really have the data to back it up. And you don't want to be the one who puts on a concert at a higher ticket price in a bigger room and everything else and it not sell out and people getting upset. So I think there needs, I mean, what we're trying to do is add a bit of science to, you know, the price variation. I'm also someone who, because we already do it with club nights and festivals, you have first release, second release, third release, fourth release. And so there's a sense of dynamic pricing, you know, with something that's there. And I think that the main objective for us, you know, when talking about the secondary market is that that the artist has control over their inventory, that they're not, that it's not some bots and algorithms out there just hoovering up lots of tickets and then holding onto them and then and speculating, that it's more that there's a sensible variation of the price, and it's not by times by 10, but it might be $5 or whatever else it is. I don't know what the answers are yet. We haven't really experimented too much with it, but I do know that the more data that we have, the better advice we can give in terms of the initial ticket price. You know, it should be something, be £30 or £25, or if I do tickets at £25, can I sell 20,000 tickets instead of just doing 10,000 at 30? And it is weird that the psychology of your audience as well, like depending on the age and, you know, I mean, we said to one artist that they could actually sell out a 10,000 cap venue at £15, but they'll struggle selling out a 2,000 cap venue at £25. So this is economics that we've been missing from the music industry. So we're just trying to add it.
Yeah, absolutely. What other ways can data be used to improve the live experience? We've obviously talked a lot about data and ticketing. Are there other ways you feel like you could look at audience data and that could improve someone's experience?
I think that is a big debate right now around human curation versus algorithms in terms of recommending you know, music to people. It's a good battle between sort of the Apple Music and Spotify, and, you know, they're going back and forth of what's better. I mean, I like the human curation. But I think that I'm more in favor of human curation than around the data side. I think that people are the best sort of, especially when you've got, you know, a finite amount of music that's out there or playing live. So that is kind of, data might be able to help sort of, you know, get people involved in it. I think that the human side is probably more important. Maybe it's just as simple as, just tell me when the show's in town. You know, maybe it's like, because the thing is, how many times have you missed out on someone coming through? You're like, they played last week. Are you kidding me? Like, just telling people, like, hey, one of your artists or an artist that you might like because you like this artist is coming into town. Like, maybe you want to go to them.
Yeah, that happens to me every single week. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, and it's like that is so. I think there's quite a lot of basic stuff that we can do around data and just you know triggering things. I think the other things we're just introducing now to Dice is reserving a ticket for your friend, and it's just using basic tools that have been around for ages, but applying them to the music industry.
Yeah, and what about on the artist side? Are there some things artists can do to improve the live experience?
I think that, I mean, first of all, is actually look at data. I mean, that'd be the first thing I'd encourage people to do. I think it's quite funny that I read an article last week about an artist who, you know, organized a tour based on Spotify plays in different cities. I was like, that shouldn't be news. That should be normal. You know, like if you've got someone in a city and playing, you know, a group there, then you should probably hit that town. That seems like very basic stuff. I think that the same with Dice is that we can kind of tell we're getting better and better as more people use Dice. You know, where you should go to, you know, how big it should be. I think that using data around festivals, like what artists work together, is kind of interesting as well. Another thing that we're, you know, testing out on Dice is merchandise. So the idea that you can buy the merchandise before the concert, it's kind of like, it seems kind of pretty basic, but it's pretty radical for some reason that you don't turn up to the show and then buy the t-shirt after the show and line up. You can actually just get it delivered to your house beforehand. But yeah, like these same things that seem kind of obvious are just not being done, and it's kind of weird.
That's always one of the things that I struggle with, and I think you probably do too, is, you know, when you're someone that thinks about the future and the future of the music business a lot, to look at other people and say, well, you should be doing this. Why aren't you doing this? You know, for me, I'm always having to walk it back and realize that not everyone thinks the way I do. And there are plenty of people who, you know, are sort of just like just starting to use different types of technology that might not even get it.
Yeah. You know what my funniest experience is, and it makes me laugh every time, is that you go into a meeting and they're like, but who's going to download an app to buy a ticket? You're like, oh my God, you're actually on your phone right now. Like, look around you in this room. Everyone is on their phone. Like, everyone is looking at their phone all the time. It's literally tapping a button and that's it. Like, it's okay. It's all right. It's not the future. Like, people are doing this right now. It seems like so many simple things are kind of seen as like revolutionary, and you're kind of like, okay, well, cool.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I'm always shocked because, you know, I put so much data out there about myself, and I'm fully fine with it. I mean, I choose what I put out there, but, you know, on all my socials and my Instagram and my Twitter, and it's all very public, and I'm still shocked by how mischaracterized I am. Like, the amount of... This is something I've told on this podcast before, but, you know, I have a dog, and my dog has a Twitter account, and, you know, it's very clearly... Like, the name is... My dog's name, The Dog. She tweets about dog-related things. or I tweet for her about dog-related things. And her Twitter ads, half the time, are actually accurate. They're, you know, dog treats, which makes perfect sense. And half the time, it's for cereal or mortgages. And I sit there and I think, someone is paying a lot of money for this ad to be seen by no one.
Yeah.
And there's just, to me, such a mismatch in all the data that we have floating around there. And no one quite knows what to do with it. And I think that's especially true in the music space.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think it's funny that your dog's Twitter is getting targeted ads. I'm going to check whether on our Twitter ad account if we can target, you know, 3 to 5 year old dogs, something. Yeah, I mean, people talk about big data and all this stuff all the time, and it's actually, I think that the first step to having a more robust and bigger music industry is, let's just take the basics and just do the basics really well. Let's look at the data and see, you know, where we should play. Let's look at the pricing and see whether or not that's the optimal price, and see whether or not it should be less or more, or where we should play, or, and let's look at other ways to monetize. But ultimately, it's like, how about we just, you know, I see these ads everywhere that says, here for the fans and all this kind of stuff. It's like, you know what, let's just be really straightforward and like, this is it. And then the data side kind of, you know, if the fans are getting involved with your product, and they're playing around with it, and they're helping sort of determine future experiences, then that's great. I think that's that'll work. But I think we're still a way off. I've been reading about Bitcoin and, you know, how publishers could use that to kind of, you know, to make it easy for artists to be remunerated, which is kind of interesting. I'm super impressed with Kobold. I've always been really impressed by them. I think when they came out, originally everyone was like, yeah, whatever, these guys don't know what they're doing, how on earth can they do these things? And probably like yourself, is that I read that article in Wired magazine where with Eminem's management, where, you know, they really use data to determined what is the fastest to be remunerated, the three writers of 8 Mile, Eminem, and two of the, a producer and a writer, had different publishers, and Kobold were able to get all of the money in much quicker, and having that access to seeing where the money was coming from and everything else, it seems so obvious, but for some, whatever reason, it took a company like an outsider like Kobold to sort of introduce that to the world, and luckily I think the other publishers are doing that too. So I think it's for the publishing, it's started to happen. Recording, it's still super early days. I mean that's why there's all this debate about where the money is circulating. And in live, I think that for us to come across as sort of radical and disruptive is great, but at the same time, it's like this is just the absolute basic stuff. There's so much stuff that we can do that we don't even know yet. We're going to look back in 10 years' time and just laugh at what used to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I've been working on some of the Bitcoin blockchain stuff too, and with a company called Revelator that are doing some amazing stuff. And yeah, I mean, that's been a lot of fun to play with, because that's very, very future focused, and that's not going to happen anytime soon, I don't think, but, you know, it's going to happen eventually, and that's going to be really incredible when it does. So I guess to sort of wrap everything up, what is the future of live music that you're trying to build look like? Like, let's just jump ahead 10 years, just for sake of argument. And, you know, you've built your product into the best thing you think it can be and the thing that you want it to be. What does that look like? Like, what does that look like? What does the concert experience look like? Like, where do you see everything in 10 years?
I mean, it's definitely about just getting rid of all the friction and all of the bullshit that's out there. It's about when you want to do something, you just go on your phone, like, cool, I want to do this tonight. You share it with your friends. You discover a brand new artist, or you go to something that you've always wanted to go to. You can do that in any city in the world. And it's just, it just seems quite seamless. You were talking about Uber before. Is that it's so weird now to call up a taxi company. Like, I was in a small town last week, and I checked my phone for Uber, and it was just like, there's not a chance you're going to get an Uber here. But then I had to call up the company, and it was so hard to kind of call it up. And the thing is that what it should be for the live music industry is that if I want to go to a concert or a festival or wherever else, I should just be able to go into an app and just buy a ticket instantly, and that's it. Like, there's no, like, millions of screens. There's no worrying if I'm paying too much or whatever else. Like, it should just be seamless. We should get rid of all the obstacles that are out there. And if I want to get the shirt for the concert, I should just be able to just buy it. If I want to request an artist to come to my town, I should just be able to request it. If as you know, all this stuff should just be, like, really straightforward.
Yeah, it's funny about, I mean, the Uber thing is funny, because I was in Portland, Oregon, which didn't have Uber until recently, and I landed at the airport very late. My flight had been delayed, and my parents live there, and I didn't want to wake them up in the middle of the night, so I thought, oh, I'll take an Uber home. And I was standing in front of the airport in Portland crying because Uber wasn't working for me. And it didn't even cross my mind that Uber might not be in a market, because I've trained to be like, oh, get an Uber. Like, now I have an Apple Watch, and it's like, oh, I hit my watch and there's a car. you know, and that's it. That's all I need to do. So when people are put in situations where it's not seamless, I think now their sort of automatic reaction is like, oh, forget this. And they just walk away. And I feel like that's one of the big challenges in the concert space is the few times that I've tried to buy tickets recently, half the time I've just walked away because it's like, this is too complicated. I don't want to have to go through 20 screens and 15 passwords. Like Ticketmaster takes more passwords than my bank account, you know? And at a certain point, I'm like, well, okay, I'm just not going to do it. And that's, I think, the worry that I think people in the live music space should have is if the barrier to entry continues to be high, you have now a new generation of consumers who are just like, oh, I can't do it in one click. I'll just go do something else that I can do in one click then.
Yeah, and I hear that every day. I hear that people just go, oh, it's too hard. They don't even bother trying to buy a ticket because they just think it's too complicated. So it's like, it's the stuff that we work really, really hard at DICE to sort of eliminate that. But it seems that you're in a space which is being challenged by other entertainment that you should make it as attractive and simple as possible to experience it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. If people want to learn more about DICE or about you, where can they go online to do that?
Yeah, so I'm only in the UK right now, but you can check it out and you can still download it from any store around the world. You can go via www.dice.fm. Our Twitter is DiceFM as well. We're not actually called DiceFM. That was the only domain that we could get as a dot. So we're just called DICE. But yeah, you can find us there.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Cool. Thank you. Cheers, guys.
That's all for this episode of the Music Business Podcast. Thank you to Hypebot for helping us put this show out. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please send me an email at kyle.bylin@gmail.com. That's kyle.bylin@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion.